Every time our athletes walk into this weight room, they're going to be pushed to the max.
Let's go!
The barbell hasn't changed in over 100 years. I can take a 25-pound plate, and we'll go out on the turf, and I'll have you hating life. We talk about straining your gut, pushing past that comfort level. I want a lot of energy.
What better breeding ground is there for being a success in life than the weight room?
Hey guys, welcome back to Iron Game Chalk Talk. I'm your host, Ron McKeefer. This is episode number 238. I want to thank you guys for listening each week. Appreciate those of you that like, share, comment. Just continues to help me shed light on the great people that we have in our profession doing fantastic things. I want to thank our sponsors and specifically Samson for bringing this episode to you for free. I only partner with companies that I trust, and Samson is very much a company that I believe in, family owned, great people, great customer service, doing fantastic things, and more importantly, giving back to the community in big, big ways. And so if you're in the market, please check them out. This week, I'm joined by Greg Day. Greg and I got a chance to hang out together over in Poland recently. He's a physio from Australia, doing big things and just done tremendous. I mean, he's had a long career that's spanned a lot of different things that we'll get into, but just a great guy. I really enjoyed watching him present and hanging out with him for the week, man. Appreciate being on the show.
Thanks, Ron. I very much appreciate the invitation and definitely enjoyed your insights into preparing college athletes in Poland. I thought it was fantastic. So, yeah, great to be here.
Oh, awesome, man. Well, hey, you've been part of Special Forces. You've been a part of Australian football. You've worked in China recently with the volleyball program. You've ran, Exos at Shanghai. Out of those locations, out of those experiences, and on the ones I didn't mention, which experience best defined you in your career?
Yeah, I was chatting to a fellow in Portugal the other day who spent some time in Chinese soccer and also with the Exos program in Shanghai. And he said to me that China's made him bulletproof, and I had to agree with him. And I think that resonates with me when you ask me that question, because the challenges that are presented in China are beyond what anyone could be prepared for that comes out of a Western system. And that challenge either causes you to run away and hide, or it causes you to find a way through the myriad of difficulties and experiences to get the success that they've asked you to achieve. So China, I would agree, has made me bulletproof. I don't feel egotistical in saying that. And I feel humble enough to say that whilst it made me bulletproof to survive a great number of challenges, it's made me even more hungry to overcome future challenges, to stay learning, and to recognize that I'm not complete. We learned every day. We learned every moment. And for that, I'm eternally grateful for that experience.
I think that's such a powerful lesson. I mean, for everybody that's listening, is so many times we want to go to the job that we think it's going to be the easy road, or, it's the best athletes, the best facilities and all those things. And it's really those times when you don't have access to those things, or it's a challenging work environment, that come out that much stronger of a professional. You grow the most as a person in those environments. And we should all strive for those opportunities.
Yeah, we absolutely should. And every athlete in every part of the world is doing the best that they can with the resources that they've got. And it's up to us to scale it down. And as Mladen Jovanovic says, look for the elephant in the room. And you develop the systems, and you develop the trends, and you say, hey, you know what? The biggest elephant in the room is the one we've got to address right now. And it doesn't matter where you are and what resources you've got. That person needs that elephant addressed. And it was fun because it made our job actually a little bit easier once you figured that out.
Right. You don't have all those experiences or be in China for any period of time without making some mistakes. What's one of the biggest mistakes that you made when working with your athletes, and how you learned from it?
Probably the biggest mistake was missing out on, or miscommunicating, that the people on the ground that we worked with every single day were the same ones that wanted us to be there. And that was definitely a mistake. The contracts were signed at a different level. We were invited over there with a mission to do great things. And when we landed there, the people on the ground that we worked with every day, they weren't necessarily the same ones that asked for our help. So what that meant is that we were potentially meeting with some resistance. And not recognizing that early enough was probably a mistake, because it had the potential to hurt relationships. And as many of us know, that probably the first two rules in the top 10 rules of coaching would be develop relationships, and the second one is see rule one. Yeah. And so if I didn't recognize that early enough, that was a mistake. I felt like I did. That probably that goes hand in hand with that element was that looking at the preparation of athletes and the preparation of teams and the development of relationships through Western eyes was potentially a mistake, that we needed to look at it through Oriental eyes, because how they view things is quite different. And that's a baptism of fire. There's no way around that except to draw on the great people that have already been there and to hit the ground running and to very, very quickly refine your goalposts.
Yeah. I think it's applicable whether or not you're going to China, you're going to Australia, you're in the U.S. and going from one college team to another. They all have their own cultures. They all have their own ways of doing things. And, you know, whenever you're inserted into a situation, you have to find, you know, it's you got two ears and one mouth, right? So you want to listen and learn and yeah. soak in and then implement as you understand. And that was something I had to learn when I worked with Special Forces, that, you know, coming in as an outsider, I mean, that's as tight-knit of a group as you can find. Coming in as a civilian or an outsider, you have to prove yourself. You have to, you know, you have to give, and then you can ask, you know.
Absolutely. And in the previous years before China, I worked with the Australian military as well as the British forces in England and in Germany, as well as working up in the, well, kind of the Highlands, but also the northern regions of Wales. And so China was the fifth country that I lived and worked in. And speaking in Poland recently was the eighth country that I visited.
Right.
The eighth country that I've worked in and the 28th country that I visited. And so the reason I bring that up is that every single culture teaches you something different, and it doesn't necessarily have to be China. You know, if I had to choose one, China stood out for me, but every single country I visited and every environment that I worked at meant you had to take your greatest principles and look at the elephant in the room and help those people move forward. But you had to do so with the flavor of that culture. And that means that you're never egotistical, you're right. Always humble. You're in their space. So it's a great lesson on how to serve. That's for sure.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I've talked a lot about, especially over the course of this last year with me doing a lot more international travel, about how, you know, just being exposed to different cultures and different countries and different ethnicities and the whole deal. It really opens your mind to what's possible using sport, you know, as a platform, but also how much, you know, that we have as, at least speaking in the U.S., how much we have to learn about the rest of the world as well. And so I've been privileged in that. You being in 28 countries, that's a PhD in and of itself, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. Sport changes lives, and it's definitely changed mine, and I'm forever grateful for that. That's for sure.
You probably got sick of me asking as many questions as I did in your presentations, but it was very
not at all.
And I think, you know, for me, I just try to be relentless when I understand things, but try to be relentless when I think that something is very applicable to what I'm doing. And you presented on really taking kind of motor control and some patterning movements and things along those lines and implementing them as into your active rest spaces, you know, whether or not you're supersetting or tri-setting with something, finding ways to insert, you know, correctives or patterning or priming movements into those opportunities. And I thought, I mean, as soon as you did it, I've always thrown mobility or maybe some metabolic type of work in those areas to keep people moving. But to really tap into motor control was something that I hadn't really thought about a lot, and you really exposed me on, and I appreciated that. Talk a little bit about motor control being a limiting factor and how you've been able to work with strength coaches to provide those opportunities to address that during lifts and not to be, you know, taken away from or pulling people out or, you know, it's in addition to instead of subtraction.
Let me answer the second element first. I think, you know, supersets can either continue the blasting of the nervous system or they can caress the nervous system. And one will take you further away from recovery and one will bring you closer to recovery. So when you're doing high volume training, you know, that's a relative term, but when you're doing high volume training, you want to be enhanced towards recovery without losing the stimulus of the training. So a superset can be one which recalibrates your nervous system after you blasted it, because most of the primary lifts, are pretty linear. They can be push, pull, press. They can be rotational, of course, but they essentially are a discrete task that says, let's go from here to there, push it again, repeat it. And they don't really require any feedback from the environment about the path that's being taken of that weight as it gets pushed. It's a very pre-planned movement that comes out of the cortex, and it doesn't take into a great account what's coming back from the environment, what's coming from the mechanoreceptors of the body. So these discrete tasks, they're pre-planned, they require very little feedback. And as a result, you end up with a nervous system just throwing absolutely everything at huge prime movers and movements. And what that can mean is that your fine motor control becomes oppressed as you go for these gross movements. And the fine motor control is actually a window into how well your nervous system is working. And if your nervous system is working well, you're very much closer towards recovery. So one of the drills that we did in Poland was a rolling drill, and we took that from off the floor and we took it into a wall drill of crossover stepping. And they've got really similar patterns where one part of the body is being asked to be statically stable whilst another body part moves around it. And of course, the other body part that's being asked to move is doing so on the background of a stable segment. So you've got different elements of mobility occurring on top of other body parts that are being stable, and you're mixing the two of them there. And that is, being unable to do those movements indicates that the nervous system is unable to dissociate. It's unable to express fine control. And when it's unable to do so, it's an indication that you're not yet prepared for your next big lift, because your nervous system is preloaded. It's going to struggle. So I use those drills as a way to enhance recovery in high volume training. And that means that I can support guys like yourself who want to push the envelope of stimulus.
Right.
And rather than hold you back, say, hey, I've got something here that's actually probably going to take you forward quicker. And that's the aim, because we're looking for big bang for buck. We're looking for results. We're looking for sustainable durability at the same time as performance output. So that brings us back to a statement that Franz Boas, the internationally recognized professor of motor learning, as well as practical speed coach and jumps coach. He said motor control might actually be the limiting factor in performance. And he was referring to jumping and sprinting, where the collapsing of a body segment, such as the collapsing of a hip, the collapsing of an ankle, or the collapsing of a knee. He stated that if a joint changed its angle, he used the word amortize, if it amortizes 20 degrees or more, what happens then is you switch from an isometric contraction of those lower body muscles into an eccentric contraction. And that's going to be a leak in energy. And so most of the muscle groups of the lower body are multipennate or unipennate muscles, but they're not the fusiform longitudinal ones. And that anatomical structure means that they are more biased towards the isometric contractions. And just quickly, what that really means is that most of the energy is stored in tendons. So you hit the ground and you bounce off the ground, and that's free energy,
right?
As opposed to hitting the ground, absorbing forces, and then having to produce them again. And that costs about four times as much energy as squeezing isometrically and reusing energy in the tendons.
Right.
So if you think about when people fatigue, and if you think about when people struggle to produce force, it may be because they've spent most of that movement expressing force and they just run out. Whereas if you're able to squeeze and express motor control to reuse the energy, then that's going to take you a lot further. The main thing behind that ability to reuse energy is that your body can detect when it hit the ground, and that every position, every joint knows exactly what feedback it's getting from the environment, and that does require a healthy nervous system to do so. So I think the two of them are pretty well linked. And there may be conjecture about whether that theory is indeed correct, but I think anecdotally I'm seeing that's a consistent limiting factor to performance.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I think, you know, what I was most impressed with was obviously, you know, I think so many physios or athletic trainers, there's a clear distinction between weight room and the rehab center or whatever. And here you were integrated completely into a weight room and being able to provide immediate feedback both to the coach and to the athlete in the setting. And that was very impressive to me because it exposes in the moment, which I think is powerful, to the coach, you know, that sometimes, you know, chasing those numbers or chasing the big lift or whatever may not be what we really need to spend in our attention in this movement versus maybe another movement. And I think you must have encountered many challenges. I mean, I know with the volleyball team in China, we have a mutual friend in Rhett Larson, that was probably easier than most. But you've probably had your fair share of experiences with coaches or strength coaches that, you know, you start rolling somebody around in the weight room and they probably want to kick you out as fast as they can. How have you overcome that, you know, with the athletes, with the coaches that are constantly that wanting to push to take a couple steps back, you know, and expose them to where those deficiencies lie?
It's actually quite easy because rolling doesn't necessarily need to be that particular recovery superset. I use that as an example, but you can choose the same combination of static stability of some body parts, dynamic stability of other body parts, and full mobility of other body parts. You can use those in any posture. It doesn't need to be on the ground. You can be in a quadruped position and you can load up that quadruped position. You can be in a half and tall kneeling. And of course you can be standing, single leg stance and split stance. And here's one example. We had some girls that were coming off some shoulder issues 3 weeks out from the World Cup. And we had to re-examine what was being done from a blasting point of view. And what we also wanted to do was to complement their high volume of overhead hitting movements, complement that with a superset of one arm pressing. And that was just to get that motor control of the shoulder girdle and the thoracic spine to just open up in the correct way. The point here is that we saw these girls doing an overhead press and many of them would go into an anterior pelvic tilt. They'd arch their lumbar spine. And that's an example of a body that's not very stable with an overhead press. So they lock out their spine to gain that stability. And all we said to Rhett was, hey, let's get these girls onto one leg and let's get them to elevate the opposite foot and knee into a triple flexion. What that meant was that their stance leg became very stable. Their overhead press, the actual load went down a little bit because that's just a safety issue on one leg, but their overhead press movement pattern became very, very clean. So we didn't necessarily need to be in rolling. And so for challenges where a coach is perhaps not too happy about you rolling around on the floor, you can still take a motor control drill and superset that into something which looks much more like a traditional, you know, strength movement, but you can tweak it so that motor control happens and you recalibrate the nervous system. And I guess that's the art of being a good observing coach and making use of the fantastic extrinsic cues that are implicit about patterning, all the great work that Nick Winkelmann has done in indicating that can change movement patterns and can change outputs. So it doesn't necessarily need to be on the floor, and you have to be cognizant of that when you're working with a strength coach that's perhaps less accepting of what you would like to do.
Sure. I think whether or not you're performing, you know, you're focused on performance, focused on motor control, they're all pieces of becoming a more robust athlete. You know, that's kind of a big buzzword that's out there right now. And, you know, you and I had talked about kind of a robust function paradigm. What is that and kind of, you know, how do you go about making a more robust athlete?
Well, a robust athlete, from the Oxford Dictionary, robust means the ability to withstand or overcome adverse conditions. And so let's imagine that you're walking in a straight line and something like the wind or another person bumps you off course. Now, that's an adverse condition, and your ability to either avoid that or to take the bump and then get back on track indicates your robustness. And we look at athletes that can take a non-linear progression towards their goals and how quickly can they adapt, absorb, produce, and get back on track. Interestingly, the NSCA ran a conference a few years back, 2012, and it was about functional training. But unfortunately, there wasn't an agenda item that said, let's define what function means. And so in those last, you know, in that 5 or 6 years, we had to sit down and thought about what it might mean to be functional. And the definition that we've been working on is that it's the ability to respond and then adapt to internal and external stimuli. And it was sometime later that I, you know, we're hearing this word about robust, and I went and searched for the current definition and found that the ability to overcome adverse and will withstand adverse conditions is really very, very similar to the ability to respond and adapt to stimuli that's either from inside you or from external to you. So right. Robust and functional are very, very, very similar. I think the main point of difference is that robust might deal much more with work capacity. And so it suits the performance coach significantly more, whereas function might work more about the competency of how well somebody moves before we add capacity on top of them. So that, I think they go hand in hand. We like to say someone's functional because they've got a minimum level of competency, and that's related to safety, it's related to efficiency, it's related to taking away handbrakes.
Right.
And then we say, if you've got those levels, you know what, let's go ahead and add capacity in a really smart way, because adding capacity is going to make you robust when, you know, the forces come at you from all sides. So how I do that in my area that supports the physical prep coach is I've got to look for those handbrakes that stop somebody from being competent so that you can safely put the load on them and stimulate them. And those handbrakes is what I look at when I'm watching my associate strength coach work in the gym. It's how I watch them when they're on the court. I've got to then take that person away and say, hey, I need to check something, because from the way that I see you're moving, I'm pretty sure that's not a strength issue or a motor control issue. I'm pretty sure you're in pain or something ain't moving. And if you give me a few minutes, let me work with that, and then I can put you back in and we can reprogram that nervous system to express the capacity that you need to.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when you're hacking performance or when you're trying to tap into that, I think that's the missing piece. I think that's where a lot of the issues arise, especially in the States, between sports medicine and performance coaches is very siloed, you know, and there isn't that observation, you know, to see it being done in sport or being done in practice or whatever it may be. And I really appreciated that approach by you and others that are similar, that are getting out of the weight room, watching practice, watching strength training sessions, and then finding ways to insert themselves in a non-invasive type of way, where it's just adding to and not subtracting from. And I think that's so important as you go through. You've been in tough environments. I mean, you mentioned China and some of these other experiences that you had. When you're in these tough environments, and you're having to be very technical, like you have to be, what have been some of the tricks? What have been some of the ways that you've kind of overcome that with either, you know, dealing with disgruntled coaches and athletes, or working with athletes that maybe they can't understand exactly what you're trying to get them to accomplish?
It comes down to asking a really simple question. What is your goal? You can ask that of a coach. You can ask that of an athlete. And if you can't get that in a language format, then you find a translator, because if you can't get that question pretty clear, everything beyond that could be completely off course. One of the questions I asked more succinctly to the head coach of China Women's Volleyball was, what's critical to success for you? And I tweaked that question by saying, well, what's critical to success for you that you think I can help you with? Because in volleyball, most critical factor for success is scoring more points than the opposition. But that technical element is up to those volleyball coaches. So I asked her specifically, what's critical to success that you think I can help you with? And she said, power and speed. So I've now got a mandate that says, all right, we need to move the needle from less power to more power, from less speed to more speed. So we test, we see where people are. And then I go in and say, what's holding those people back from giving us more power and more speed? And our strength coach wants to write a great program that stimulates the power and the speed. And my job is to make sure that he can do a significantly high proportion of that program so he can get the effect that he wants. And one of the ways I do that is to look at the four barriers to performance. And the four barriers to performance is that someone is either in pain, inflammation, they're toxic, they're poison. We call that bad energy. Okay, that's the first barrier. And that's the priority, that's the health element. If you're not healthy, trying to get capacity is just going to be, you know, pissing in the wind, pardon my French. But with the second element there is if somebody can't get their body parts into a position to begin a movement, you know, they can't get triple flexion range, they can't finish triple extension, then you're going to run out of energy to express the force. And we call that mobility. Yep. And the research tells us pretty clear, if you're limited or if you're asymmetrical below a minimum level, then that's going to be a barrier to you pushing forward. The third energy is that the third barrier is that if you're healthy, you're not in pain, if you've got great mobility, but you can't control it, then every step you take and every movement that you take is going to be real deviation from an optimal or most efficient pattern of movement. And that's called leaking energy. And that's where Franz Bosch has really hit the nail on the head. And I think that third energy there, that third barrier, leaked energy, says if you're trying to deliver force, capacity, endurance, power, and the path of movement that you take is deviating all over the place, that's really inefficient. It slows you down and you just leak energy out of the way. So the fourth barrier is that deficient energy, and our strength and conditioning professionals are fantastic at developing abundance of energy, and that's work capacity. But my job is actually really easy. Just take away the bad energy, the blocked energy, the leaked energy, so you can put your foot down on that car. I think of myself as a mechanic, and I think of the performance coaches as an engineer. They want to build a bigger engine. We want to upload some new software together into that engine. But if you've got a flat tire, a handbrake on, or a leaking oil drain or electrical fault, unfortunately, it doesn't matter how big that engine is, you're probably going to struggle to get the input into the engine to deliver. And of course, sometimes you've got to park the car away from the racetrack. You can't change a flat tire whilst it's moving, but you got to get that car straight back out there pretty quickly because it's not about me, it's about that performance. And I think if we break it down to those four barriers, our work doesn't become very difficult. Just go and find that bad energy, blocked energy, leaked energy, so you can get ahead with developing abundant energy.
Yeah, that's great. I love that. You know, oftentimes I think even when like I'm talking to, you know, high school football coaches or soccer coaches or whatever that are well-intended but misinformed, you know, their intentions are good. You know, I think there's a number of strength coaches that are, their intentions are good, but they're maybe misinformed when it comes to motor control or building a more robust athlete. What would be your recommendations to those professionals to become more educated, to shorten, to, you know, because a lot of them are in elite type of settings, even, you know, how do you shorten that learning curve for those coaches?
The word that pops into my mind is something that Mladen again has been talking about. It's called agile periodization. And what you're basically saying is that you can put a plan in place, but be prepared to throw that plan out in about 3 days' time. And, right. And that is because where an athlete gets to is going to influence what you have to do next. Now, that comes back to the answer that I'm going to tell you. You've got to be able to evaluate where somebody is from the point of view of each of those four barriers to performance. And it's pretty easy to evaluate speed and power and strength. There's 100 or more different tests that can give you some insight into where somebody is. And they've got varying degrees of reliability and validity. And that's fine. But it's also important that we have an evaluation system that tells us what kind of pain we're dealing with, if it's clinical. We have an evaluation system that's robust enough to say, you know what, we all agree that hip is not giving us 120 degrees of flexion. Right. And if you're not getting 120 degrees of flexion, that's got ramifications for all sorts of movement patterns. And we also need an evaluation system that tells us quite quickly whether motor control is competent or not. As it turns out, there is excellent evaluation systems in play, and that's part of my journey, is to find how am I going to know very quickly about each of those four barriers. And I, as one of the instructors for the functional movement systems, one of the main reasons I got on board with them is because the evaluation systems are absolutely exceptional. They're very quick. They're very useful. They tell me what I need to do, whether it fits into one of those four energy categories. And that allows me to very quickly cut through and make those changes. So the answer to your question really is have a great evaluation system, because right. that tells you which tool you're going to use, rather than build up your education portfolio based on all these great tools. Start with a great evaluation system first, and then you will find the gaps in your knowledge that says I need to go and grab that tool because my evaluation tells me we need to use this thing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I always say that, you know, you got to ask, you got to learn to ask the right questions, you know, and part of that is determining what, you know, what you need to evaluate. And then once you see what you have, then you continue to ask questions from there. And we can't be all things to everybody, you know, as coaches. Yeah. We got to, you know, we have to surround ourselves with great people and great teams of people. And there's no doubt that you've been that to a number of coaches.
And if I could just chime in there just quickly, sometimes there's a difficulty with the evaluations in that you can't always take somebody away from a setting and run those evaluations. And the great thing is that you don't have to.
Right.
If you can take some of the great evaluation methods that we have, and Nick Winkelman has definitely contributed to that, but there is a concept known as a performance bandwidth. And it is well written about, and I have written about it as well, and we present about it when we talk motor control. But it effectively says your sport and your population of people and the task that that person is doing, you should be able to say whether that's generally acceptable or whether it's outside your realms of acceptable. And you might say that's a mistake, the way that you lifted, and I'm going to call it a mistake because that puts you in the bottom third of our group. And the bottom third means you're most likely to be attrition.
Right.
It also means that that's a mistake and it's actually unsafe. And the other one is it's not unsafe. It's not really in the bottom third, but it definitely makes you less efficient. And if it's less efficient, you're less likely to actually achieve the success that I want. So we have this bandwidth and there's a great way to explain that. And it would take longer than what we've got here today, but you don't need always to do a formal evaluation. If you can spot when somebody's outside your bandwidth, then you've got to step in and say, hey, my very rudimentary evaluation says we need to find out which of the four barriers are present that dragged you outside that bandwidth. So it doesn't always need to be I don't have time to do this evaluation. It can be use the observation, the eyes that you've got. And it doesn't always take years of experience. You get around good guys like yourself and know what to look for. And guys like us that can also know what to look for. And we say, we can teach these things pretty systematically. So, yeah.
That's fantastic. And this is probably going to cut out here in a second. So I'll just send you another, link if it cuts out. But
okay.
We end the show with some resources. What's the best piece of coaching advice you ever received?
Leave your ego on the hook.
Love it. Where'd you learn that from?
I actually learned that at the new facility that I consult out of called Virtus Human Performance, which is about 10 minutes down the road from my home. That's where I consult whenever I'm not away traveling and teaching. You know, we've got a bunch of rules up on the wall and I've got a bunch of quotes up on the wall that just give people some – just keep them on track, and one of them is just leave your ego on the hook.
I love it.
Yeah.
What about a book, app, and website recommendation?
From a book point of view, I like the book The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. It came to me at a time where I was probably spending a bit too much time thinking about the past and unable to really get a handle on what I wanted to do in the future, and I was just bouncing between the past and the future. And that meant that I wasn't really doing anything at all. And just making me more aware that being present, being in this moment right now, whether that moment is a second, whether that moment is the next 3 days, whether that moment is a 3 or 4 week period is less of concern, but giving your energy to the task at hand is the only time that you've got. You know, you don't have yesterday and you don't have tomorrow. and what you do in these moments, these 3 days, defines how quickly and what direction you go forward. So the power of now was really pivotal for me at that particular time, and that's probably why I throw it up as a book. In terms of the best app, I'm a music guy. I love Shazam. I love that it tells me what songs are at the moment. And I use that, if I could go in scientifically here, the music is fantastic for the prefrontal cortex. It's the area of the brain that connects to the rest of the motor system. The more that we play, the more that our movement enhances our ability to both think cognitively and also to express energy. And there are definitely great music elements that stimulate our brains in that way. And so I'm a big fan of music, and Shazam is one of my best friends there. Website, let me see, functional movement systems. And I don't say it just because I'm an instructor. I think the body of brains that are behind the information that comes out of that, whether that be written articles or whether it be video, whether it be the options to do courses that span different evaluations along that continuum of bad, blocked, leaked, and deficient energy, it's definitely been a website that I would consider to be world-class. So,
oh, those are great. Those are all great ones. You know, I think, like I told you over there in Poland, I mean, I've just been so impressed by you and your knowledge, one, your passion, two. And I think, you know, I've had both experiences in the U.S. of working with sports medicine professionals that, you know, it's been, you know, somewhat confrontational, and it's also, and then there's been the ones that have been, a mutual respect and a continual learning from one another. And I think, you know, that's the way it should be, right? That's the, you know, and the whole time you were speaking, the whole time just talking to you, I sat there the whole, and just said, man, I wish I could learn from this guy every single day. So thanks so much for coming on the show and sharing with everybody.
Hey, man, I really appreciate it. And just quickly, my job is not to keep people in the clinic. My job is to give them back to you so you can put the gas pedal down and get the results. My job is not about injury prevention. It's not about injury reduction. It's about preparing people to perform. And we sit side by side in that element. We've got different tools that allow us to do it. I think that's how we all should work together. And I'm super glad to have met you in Poland, and thanks very much for inviting me onto the show.
Absolutely. Thanks.
That's it for this episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk. Thanks to this week's guest, as well as our sponsors, for bringing this episode to you for free. Make sure to check out ronmckeefrey.com, where you can join our mailing list, find the show notes, including all the links and resources mentioned, and information about Coach McKeefrey's other products. While you are there, please join Coach McKeefrey in the comments section thanking our guest for sharing. If you haven't subscribed to Iron Game Chalk Talk on YouTube or iTunes yet, make sure to do so. Comments, ratings, and reviews are always welcome. Coach McKeefrey can be found on Twitter at @rmckeefrey. On Facebook and YouTube at @ron.mckeefrey. That's it for this week. Be sure to check back next week for another great episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk.